Hello, strong, feisty women. Some of you may recognize my voice. I'm Celine Yeager, host of the Hit Play Not Pause podcast. Throughout my career as a professional health and fitness writer and now a podcaster, I hear countless questions from women who are trying to understand how their ever-changing hormones impact their sports performance. So we decided to serve up some answers in a brand new series called Hormonal that we will be releasing on the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast feed. Throughout this four-part series, reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Carla DiGirolamo and I will be tackling topics like periods, the pill, pregnancy, and conditions like PCOS, all from the perspective of sports performance. If you aren't already, follow the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast and stay tuned for our first episode releasing on April 15th. Also, have questions you want answered? Send us a voice note at speakpipe.com/hormonal and we'll get it answered on the show.
Came into the tunnel and realized in the darkness that, you know, unless I fell flat on my face, I was going to probably win the first woman's Olympic marathon. And then thought, are you capable of carrying the title that will come with winning this race?
I think Scott's reaction, and I don't think he was alone, was that we don't want what Julie did to turn this into a freak show, freak show, freak show.
Some people, I'm sure, had funny feelings about it. I know the men did. I didn't really care.
Art is one of those things that can unite people with differences. It's not, you know, about skin color and, you know, all these other socioeconomic differences. You want your team to win, to win.
I'm Celine Yeager.
I'm Sarah Gross.
This is Nine, Voices for Title IX, powered by Inside Tracker.
A podcast that tells the stories behind the law that changed everything.
This is Nine.
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 Hey, Celine.
Hey, Sarah.
We didn't decide beforehand who was going to say hi first. So that's what happens when we go off script. It's just craziness. So we are in episode one of Nine Voices for Title IX, powered by Inside Tracker. And I just want to take a minute here to thank the woman who did the interview this week for this show. So Haley Chura, she is the co-host of our longest running podcast here at Feisty called Iron Women. So many folks listening will know Haley. And Haley herself, you know, she even talks about it, how much she benefited from Title IX. She was an NCAA swimmer turned professional triathlete. She's a 70.3 and an Ironman champion. But Haley's also had the opportunity to go to the Olympic trials in two different sports and three different times. So swimming, and she went to the marathon trials I went to it right before COVID, Atlanta, where there was like, that was, sorry, speaking of women's sports, I know that's what this podcast is about, but they're watching 500 women actually who all could run 2:45 or faster for a marathon was insane.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Anyway, on to the show for today. Celine, what do we have coming up?
Okay. So she interviews Wendy Mink, who is the daughter of Patsy Mink, who was the main author of Title IX.
Wow.
She is also the co-author of Patsy's biography, which is Fierce and Fearless, Patsy Takamoto Mink, the first woman of color in Congress. And I have to say, I loved this interview because I didn't know very much about the background of this legislation before we started this series. And this is the first one that I personally listened to. Yeah. And I realized that this legislation was crafted by a woman who was literally setting out to change the future for all of us. Like, she felt the urgency of seeing her daughter facing the same structural baked-in sexism of not being accepted by educational institutions simply because she was female, and sought to change that. And I was like, wow, this is everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've got chills when you're talking, like, because it, and I think that this particular interview underlines the fact that the law was largely about education. Sounds like Patsy Mink's original observations. She herself, I mean, I won't give too much away, but she herself was denied access to medical school from numerous different schools when she applied, and said, this is enough. you know, like women deserve to be educated and equal in an equal way. And she just spent her entire life changing that. I also found this incredible. And interestingly, the law, I didn't realize this before I did my homework on this, but the law itself that we call Title IX was actually changed its name in 2002 to the Patsy T. Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act. That's well-deserved.
Well-deserved. And I didn't know that either. I didn't know until we were getting ready to do this intro. And that's really cool because seeing how she fought for this legislation and pushed and pushed and pushed and didn't, you know, just didn't stand down. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, her daughter calls for us all to do the same, you know, and I think that the messages here are so important as we are seeing things that we thought were settled, you know, law be pushed back and nothing is ever fully settled. And there's always work to be done. And the show is a really good, really good reminder of that.
Yeah, I was really struck when she said, like, she felt her mom used her own sadness and despair, kind of, mm-hmm. over the plight of women to press forward, like, to make such positive change. And I really sort of related to that. I think sometimes, though we might not see it externally, like, I feel angry, you know, and, like, using that anger, I, like, intentionally try to use that anger for the change, like to try to make change as well. So I've really related to that and loved that. And then I also think like this interview sets the stage really well for the rest of what's coming up. Cause I think we're spending the next 8 episodes after this talking very specifically about sport because we didn't see, you know, we didn't necessarily see it coming that Title IX was gonna have such a big impact on women's sports. But this definitely sets the stage for like what the law was about broadly in the sense of like the Civil Rights Act and mm-hmm. all the other things that were going on at the time.
So. Yeah. And again, like it's all a living document, right? And that we need to keep it living and need to keep pressing on.
Absolutely. So let's have a few words from our sponsors and then enjoy the episode.
Raise your hand if you believe we need more women and more overall diversity at our triathlons. Now keep that hand up if you want to be part of the solution. The team at Lifetime, the nation's premier healthy way of life brand, is right there with you. Their main focus? The iconic Verizon New York City Triathlon, coming up on July 24th. For this year's New York City Tri, Lifetime replaced their registration lottery, added a duathlon distance, and implemented a rookie refund program, all to get more racers, like you, of every age, skill level, and background to take on the concrete jungle. They have women, but not enough. They have non-binary participants, but they need more. They have athletes from 39 states and 17 countries, but they want to cover every corner of the globe. Let's write a better future for endurance sports together. Visit nyctri.com today to reserve your spot to race the greatest city in the world. That's nyctri.com.
Female hair loss is a topic few of us want to talk about, but it impacts nearly 30 million women, so we should. And that's why we appreciate that Bonafide's healthy hair and scalp product, Silvessa, is one of our show partners. With Silvessa, Bonafide designed the first comprehensive system designed to restore and protect hair and skin affected by estrogen decline from the inside and out. It consists of a 3-part system containing a daily capsule, hair serum, and skin serum to be combined for healthier looking skin and hair. During a 12-week clinical study, Bonafide found that 92% of women saw improvement in hair volume, 82% saw improvement in hair thickness, and 67% saw improvement in scalp coverage. Over 8,300 uncompensated doctors in the U.S. recommend Bonafide's products. All of their products are prescription and hormone-free. And for listeners today, we want to give you 20% off your first purchase of Silvessa and or any of Bonafide's products when you subscribe to any product. Just go to hellobonafide.com/Title IX and use the promo code Title IX. That's hellobonafide, BONAFIDE.com/Title IX and the code Title IX, all caps, TITLE, and the number 9 for 20% off at checkout. For the best prices and free shipping, go directly to the hellobonafide.com/Title IX website. That is their best offer anywhere, so check it out and use the promo code Title IX today.
Wendy, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me.
So I just want to jump into questions here. We're going to talk a lot about your mother, Patsy Takamoto Mink, because, and I want to start with kind of a fun question. I read that early in her congressional career, she had an issue with a swimming pool. And I'm sure many of our listeners come from the endurance sports world. I come from the endurance sports world, and we have all dealt with difficult pool or gym hours, but your mother's situation was a bit different. Can you tell me about her victory for congressional women swimming?
Well, I'm not sure how much of a victory it was, actually, but what the situation was that there were, I believe, 11 women in the House of Representatives when she first arrived in Congress in January of 1965. And the rules of the U.S. House of Representatives gym segregated women's participation in the gym to only certain very limited hours on very limited days of the week. It was like an hour and a half for an hour and a half per spell for maybe 3 days in a week. So it was clearly an unequal situation for access to athletic facilities, which for most of the women particularly was galling because they wanted to swim in the swimming pool, do laps and that sort of thing. So they staged three of them staged a protest against this discrimination against women House members and tried to gain equal access to athletic facilities in the U.S. House of Representatives, to gain equal time and integrated time for use of the pool, and so forth. And they gained slightly expanded hours, but they didn't gain the full comprehensive sense of equality. And they certainly didn't get locker rooms. So the rest of the battle got played out 20 years later or so, but they took the first step in sort of exposing this inequality in Congress, this sort of anti-democratic exclusion of some members from participating in a place where the guys did a lot of business. You know, you hear all the time of male Congress members talking about making deals with fellow male Congress members or coming to understandings over, you know, swimming or basketball or things like that. And the women were completely excluded from that. And so they wanted to stand up for themselves, not only for the athletics, but also for the access to common social spaces where business was conducted.
Yes. And it might've taken 20 more years, but I'm sure that women in Congress today are thankful for your mom and those steps that she took and recognizing inequality and taking action to make some major changes, which is kind of a theme of her life. And one of those big changes came in 1972 when Patsy was the co-author and sponsor of Title IX, which in 2002 was officially renamed the Patsy T. Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act. And so you, along with Judy Zuchan Wu, co-authored your mother's biography, Fierce and Fearless, Patsy Takamoto Mink, First Woman of Color in Congress. It was just released earlier this month. And so you are someone, you knew your mother intimately, and you also are her biographer. So can you tell us a little bit in that same theme of taking life experiences and noticing things and taking action, how her key life experiences influenced her commitment to create legislation that was centered on gender equality in education?
Well, I think that her life experiences were instructive to her, as was her reaction to some of those experiences. But she took not only her own life experiences, but the experiences that she learned from others that were also important into kind of a package of action that she thought it was necessary to carry forward into policies like Title IX. For herself, In 1999, which was 3 years before she passed away, she gave a speech in the House of Representatives about the importance of Title IX and the struggles to achieve Title IX and the struggles to maintain Title IX, in which she sort of pulled the thread through in her own life that led to her thinking about the centrality of achieving a law for gender equity in the educational context. When she was in college, she experienced race discrimination and took action against that. As a student enrolled at the University of Nebraska, she was discriminated against for purposes of housing. So that sort of strain of discrimination sort of was etched very deeply in her consciousness. As a recent or soon to be graduating senior from college, she applied to medical schools and was rejected. In some cases, she was told it was because she was a woman. In general, one can deduct that it was because she was a woman, because at the time, only 5% of enrolled students in medical schools were female. When she then went on to law school, when she graduated from law school, nobody would hire her, explicitly saying that she was a woman, she was a married woman, she was a mother. All three of that basket of excuse was proffered as reasons why firms didn't want to hire her. When she tried to take the bar exam in Hawaii after returning from law school, she was initially denied because she was married to a man who was not born in Hawaii, born and raised in Hawaii. So she was assigned the domicile identity of her husband, irrespective of her own origins and her own citizenship and so forth. So all of those kinds of experiences of exclusion and subordination and dismissal surely, you know, sort of informed her consciousness, both in the employment arena and in the education arena. But I'd have to say, and she says this in the 1999 speech that she gave, that it was seeing sort of very similar discrimination visited upon me that really sort of sparked a sense of urgency in her mind about acting to stop discrimination in education. Because it's not so much that it was me, I was her daughter, it was that I was sort of representative of what was happening to the generation of girls that I belonged to. And it was the same stuff that had been imposed upon her generation of girls when they were coming up through the educational system. And the idea that sort of, you know, you would have reproduced in perpetuity the same structures that held women back, held girls back, was something that she was not willing to really tolerate. And that's how she acquired the sort of burning spirit behind what ultimately was achieved of as Title IX.
And you mentioned some of the inequalities that Title IX addressed, which include admissions to college, which both you and your mother experienced, housing quotas. And this is primarily a women's sports podcast. And now Title IX is often equated with women's sports, but I mean, it wasn't always that way. Like you said, the initial goals weren't exactly athletics related. So when did it become clear that the legislation would have such a profound impact on women's athletics?
Well, during the run-up to actual enactment of Title IX, Title IX as a package was not that controversial. There were little fires that burned here and there along the way, but nobody paid tremendous attention to Title IX because it was part of a much larger policy package that included much bigger fires over school desegregation and college student financial assistance and things like that. So, I don't know whether the athletics lobby was awakened, the male athletics lobby was awakening in the run-up to 1972, but they sure woke up fast in terms of action in the immediate aftermath of passage of Title IX in 1972, and began efforts, lobbying legislators, getting them to attach provisions to various forms of legislation that would curtail the application of this gender equality concept in its implementation, to curtail it so that it wouldn't apply to athletics. And so they tried, you know, they tried different language to amend implementation so that it wouldn't affect revenue producing sports, which meant men's football, basically, right? They tried language that would, prevent Title IX from being applied to physical education activities and instruction. Various sort of efforts like that, beginning in early 1973, all the way until the summer of 1975, when the final rules that would determine how Title IX was going to be implemented went into effect. And during that period, the whole fight over athletics was what sort of captured, or I guess it was the most visible struggle. And you had all these male coaches of college football teams and whatever, waging war against it in very public ways, holding press conferences and things like that. You had NCAA leaders saying that Title IX was insane. The public imagination was certainly captured by this whole question of whether or not there could be equality for women in girls and women in athletics. So it was never the only aspect of Title IX for sure, but it was clearly a very important implication of what equity was going to mean. And it was an implication that the status quo was not happy with accepting.
So in the book, you describe Patsy as an intersectional feminist before intersectionality was even an official term. And we often think of Title IX in terms of gender equality, but in writing, implementing, and defending the legislation, because as you just described, things weren't done in 1972, the struggle continued. But throughout that whole process, was Patsy also considering equality in areas outside of gender?
Well, she was certainly an ardent advocate for civil rights, and she was also an ardent advocate for various educational measures and other measures that either mitigated or would set the course towards ending poverty. And those things come together in how you conceive of educational equity, right? It's not just sort of a grand theory that's pronounced that, all girls and women shall be equal, and then whoever has the means to achieve that equality can come and claim it, right? In her view, you had to have, not necessarily as part of the policy that was called Title IX, but as collateral policies, as contributing policies, you needed to have resources made available for girls and women of various economic locations so that they could access education on an equal footing. You needed to have policies in place that would make sure that the experiences that face many girls and women, for example, pregnancy and parenting, would not become impediments to pursuit of educational opportunity and so forth. And you needed to sort of approach the whole question of equality from the point of view of the least advantaged woman, the least advantaged girl, not just the girl who, made straight A's in college and was bound for law school. That person needed to be guaranteed equal access too, but she wasn't the only one who was going to be part of this redistribution of opportunities to include girls and women in the United States.
In 2002, on the 30th anniversary of Title IX, Patsy is quoted as saying, "While it is wonderful that many young girls and women today take it for granted that they'll be offered equitable educational opportunities, must not forget our struggle for the passage of Title IX." So in 2002, I was a junior in high school, and I was definitely one of those young women that Patsy was referring to who were taking my equitable educational and athletic opportunities for granted because I was preparing to be a collegiate swimmer at the University of Georgia. But however, since then, I will say I'm proud that I have grown up a bit and I have learned to appreciate what that kind of opportunity I had and what a relatively new experience that was for someone like me to swim in college. So when I look at Patsy's quote and I think about what she says about remembering the struggle, do you think she also means, you know, we, you know, me, people who have benefited from Title IX, we also just need to join that struggle and make sure we keep it? Is that what she's referring to?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what she means. I think later in that speech, she goes on to talk about the sort of the anniversaries being not just a moment for celebrating what we've accomplished, but as moments to rededicate ourselves, each generation, to making sure that Title IX remains a living, breathing policy, making sure that girls and women know it exists and can deploy it, and make sure that the guidance and regulations that that determine how it's going to be enforced and implemented are written in a way that will help the people that are intended to be the beneficiaries of Title IX. So she calls for vigilance, and that means for all of us. She wants all of us, or she wanted all of us, to engage in the struggle, because if you look through the decades after the 1975 challenge by the athletics lobby and so forth, the struggle was never over. You know, the struggle about protecting, defending Title IX, keeping it on the books, the struggle to make sure that it was enforced equitably, all of that was raging in the 80s. It was raging in the 90s. All kinds of backlash against girls and women's equity in the educational process and in the athletics scenario especially emerged in all of those decades. So it was never something that you could just sort of say one and done, you know, okay, we have equality now, let's rest on our laurels. And, you know, as anybody knows who's reading the newspapers today, girls and women in schools and in high schools and colleges are still fighting for equitable facilities, equitable resources, and so forth, in order to make the promise come true.
And we have seen some recent victories for equality in women's sports. We've seen the equal split of World Cup bonuses between the U.S. women's and men's national soccer team. And for the first time in the history of Ironman triathlon, my sport, this October's World Championships in Hawaii will feature an equal number of women and men professional qualifiers. So these victories aren't happening in federally funded educational and institutions, and so they're outside the scope of Title IX. But do you think these wins are an indirect result of Title IX?
I definitely think so. I think that obviously the professional sports and the adult competitions are not directly reached by Title IX. But I think that, you know, once it was admitted that girls needed access to physical education on an equal basis with boys, right, which was the big struggle in the mid 1970s, that began a process wherein, you know, a whole mass of young girls, young women, could develop their talents in athletics, even discover their talents and interests in athletics, and then go on to pursue it in arenas that you know, extend beyond the actual educational environment. So yes, I definitely think that Title IX is part of this whole explosion of talent, and definitely, you know, is kind of an anchor or an inspiration or something like that behind the fight for equitable sharing of revenue and things like that by male and female teams.
So recently I was talking to a man and he casually mentioned that he was on a collegiate swim team until it was canceled due to Title IX. So I'm sure you've been in a situation like this, as have many of our listeners. Do you have a good response for this kind of comment?
Well, I don't know if I have a good response. I mean, part of my response is that the person probably doesn't know his facts, because you know, Title IX was never intended, and there's nothing in the language of the regulations or the law that suggests that Title IX is about cramping educational opportunities for anyone on behalf of some other group of people. You know, individual schools make their decisions. And sometimes they, in order to sort of not have to bear responsibility for the decisions that they're making about the teams they want to support, they'll blame Title IX as the, you know, the reason why they're cutting back on a male sport. We saw a lot of this in the 1990s with cutbacks at university level for things like wrestling, right? And it's really wrong to blame Title IX. Title IX is about creating a palette of inclusion in athletic activities. And there are perfectly, you know, predictable guidelines for how schools shall be measured in their pursuit of that equity. Title IX does not demand that there have to be exactly equal numbers of teams, or that there has to be exactly or that there needs to be co-educational access to football or anything like that, right? Title IX is about making advances towards equity. Title IX is about making sure that the interests and talents and you know, sort of demands of young women are attended to the same extent that they are for young men. And you know, that's not a soundbite, but it's a very frustrating kind of blame game that gets perpetrated against Title IX and against girl and women's sports by male teams that are suffering from cutbacks. They need to protest their schools, you know, to make sure that their schools are making proper decisions, but they shouldn't blame equality for the decisions that are being made.
A part of me does just feel sorry for him that he hasn't read your book yet. But so I think throughout the stories of legislative victories that are chronicled in your book, it's clear that Patsy didn't work on her own. So it's also very clear that she was an incredibly effective leader with this ability to make sure every member of her team was recognized and felt valued. So how do you think she developed that leadership skill?
You know, I really couldn't point to anything in particular, or, you know, like a leadership course or something that she took where she learned that strategy. I think it was the commitment to collaboration, I think, was kind of something that came naturally. It was there in her very first political struggle, which was as a student of color at the University of Nebraska protesting discrimination in housing. She led that protest. She was the one who wrote letters to the editor of the student newspaper and complained to the administration or whatever, but she built a coalition that lifted up her voice, and she in turn lifted up their voices, and ultimately they secured a change. So I think that was a learning experience that she carried forward into political life, into policymaking life, that you know, that coalition and solidarity are kind of important values to practice in pursuing your activism, whether it's, you know, at the grassroots level or in the halls of the legislature.
And you also write about Patsy's fearlessness. You noted that she often stood up for issues that, in her words, were, quote, ahead of the majority. And she even ran for president when she knew she didn't have the votes to win. Do you ever remember her feeling defeated or questioning her decisions after a political loss?
I don't really have a clear memory of her questioning her political decisions. I do remember her sadness, or I don't know what is a more appropriate word, upon defeat. Her first real defeat came in 1959. Hawaii had just been admitted as a state. candidates were running for the U.S. House of Representatives for the very first time in the new state. And she ran and she lost that election. And it was a particularly vicious campaign. And there was all kinds of misogyny that was deployed in the course of that campaign. And, you know, by the end of it, she certainly knew that she was not going to win. But when she did lose, you know, when the loss was confirmed on election night, she despaired, I think. She despaired for 24 hours over the ways in which stereotypes and biases, bigotry, could sort of shut people down. But she was never somebody who sort of remained in that frame of mind for long. She always sort of would take a feeling of sadness or frustration or anger or despair and try to turn it inside out into a reason to press forward politically. You may not be able to press forward in the way you thought you were going to be going, but you could still press forward for the things that were your goals in the first place, which for her were always issues like peace, like equality, like social justice, like the environment, right? I mean, none of those things depend upon a single individual winning a single election, right? So her whole philosophy was, she would have, you know, really been happy to be a champion in elective office at that moment. But if she's not, she needed to figure out other ways to keep those fights going, to sort of keep on keeping on.
And how lucky we all are that she didn't stop in 1959, because she did so many incredible things after that. I want to ask about you, because you grew up as a child of a public figure and a public figure who had so many firsts to her name. What was that like for you?
When she was doing the first thing, which was primarily 50s and 60s and a little bit maybe in the 70s, she wasn't self-consciously trying to be the first anything. She was sort of doing what she felt called to do. So I wasn't really aware that she was a first. I mean, sometimes my father would say, oh, so did you know that you're the first, blah, 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 whatever the situation was. But that was not really the sort of at top of mind around the dinner table, for sure. The wider public didn't herald her as a first during those years either. The wider public treated her as an anomaly, as sort of a, you know, as a thing to be explained, not as a new accomplishment to be cheered. So I never had the sense from sort of the public's reaction to what she did, whether it was becoming a practicing attorney in the territory of Hawaii, or being elected to the territorial and then the state legislature, or being elected to Congress. I never had the sense from the general public that she was accomplishing a first. I had the sense that she was considered an anomaly, and by enough people considered an anomaly in a good way, that she, you know, would win elections. My main experience of childhood was mainly around the issues that she was fighting for. And I was somehow both a very nosy child and also, I guess, a child with a deep political sort of curiosity. So I paid close attention to the political work she was engaged in. And that was probably unusual for the time, but it certainly made for a fascinating childhood to, you know, go to protests and rallies and watch other people recruit support and help my mother and watch my mother assist in all of that. That was probably a very different childhood than most.
And you did sort of follow in her footsteps as an activist and have continued her work. Did that feel like, I mean, it sounds like that was totally by your own initiative that, again, I do think it, you're talking your book about being 6 years old and recognizing the importance of what your mother did. And I think that's incredible. I mean, I do think that is a little unusual, but you didn't necessarily rebel and think I need to do something totally different. You felt comfortable following her path. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Well, I was, maybe this is a strategy that she and my father self-consciously adopted, but I don't think so. First of all, I was an only child. And so it's probably easier when it's just one child that's involved in this kind of dynamic. I was very integrated into their activities. And it was a different time where you could take your kid to lots of places that you wouldn't necessarily take your kid today. So I got to see a lot of what she was working on, and I could see not only how important it was to her and how important it was to my father, but also why it was important. You know, like when I would go with her to picket lines with striking workers, you know, I could see why it was so important that those workers got some justice in their demands for a higher wage kind of thing. And those things all sort of registered deeply in my consciousness as things that I thought were important to struggle for. And so I went about growing up to do that kind of work myself, not as a candidate, not as a elected person, not even as a public person particularly, but certainly sort of committed to the same causes with a sort of camaraderie with my mother around them.
And so I listened to your interview on the Asian American History 101 podcast, and you called the current moment in politics so much darker and scarier than any moment in your political life. So do you have advice for people who are listening, and they might not be quite as fierce or fearless as your mother, but they want to follow the trail that she blazed? What can we be doing to continue her fight and your fight for equality?
Well, I think we have to just keep on fighting. The terrain shifts, you know, as rights are taken away and or the exercise of rights is cramped, in particular by the Supreme Court. We need to be actively figuring out other ways to accomplish those same objectives. But I think we just need to keep on fighting, and we need to, you know, buck each other up along the way. And we also need to know that sort of an ethical politics is a politics that is not necessarily going to win every time. An ethical politics is a politics that keeps on pursuing the just ends and keeps on standing up to powers that would crush the just ends. And, you know, that's about it. We just need to keep on keeping on, really. And I hope there have been dark times in the past, for sure. And I think we can learn from my mother's life and from her and other, activists who have had long political careers. We can learn something about how important it is to articulate the just arguments, to wage the politics of principle and so forth. Even if in the moment that you're doing that, you don't win, you know, a year down the road, you might have a new platform to re-insinuate those ideas into a new and larger context. So, yeah, it's a dark time, but I think that the only way we find the light is by creating it through activism.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for joining me today. And I so appreciate you talking about yourself and your mother. I really appreciate your book, Fierce and Fearless. We'll definitely include a link to that in our show notes, so hopefully all of our listeners pick that book up. And I'm also just so thankful. I'm glad I get to talk to you as the dog goes crazy in the background. I don't know if you can hear that, but I'm so grateful I got to talk to you because I recognize now again that my life would be totally different without your mother's work, without your work. And so I am thankful, and I'm going to take this interview and our conversation and do what I can to stand up and to continue that struggle, because it is terrifying to think that others might not have the opportunities I've had, but I'm thankful for the help I've had in getting to where I am now. And I am hopeful that myself and a lot of our listeners do keep that fight going, even when things seem bad, over time, as you said, your mother's life shows, we can make real progress. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Whether you run, ride, hike, or swim, you understand what it means to push harder, reach farther, and go the extra mile. This relentless drive runs in your blood. That's why Inside Tracker provides you with a personalized plan to build endurance, boost energy, and optimize your health for the long haul. Created by leading scientists in aging, genetics, and biometrics, Inside Tracker analyzes your blood, DNA, and fitness tracking data to identify where you're optimized and where you're not. You'll get a daily action plan with personalized guidance on the right exercise, nutrition, and supplementation for your body. And when you connect Inside Tracker to your Fitbit or Garmin, you'll also unlock real-time recovery pro tips after you complete your workout. It's like having your own personal trainer and nutritionist in your pocket. For a limited time, you can get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store. Just go to insidetracker.com/feisty. That's insidetracker.com/feisty.
Feisty Media's Title IX series is proudly partnered with Velo Rosa. Velo Rosa is a women-owned and operated cycling apparel company that creates mix-and-match cycling wear to make women feel comfortable, confident, and beautiful. Created by two avid women cyclists, they know the importance of high-performance biking shorts and jerseys that fit a woman's body. It doesn't work to shrink and pink men's gear and expect it to work for women. Velo Rosa believes cycling wear should be fun, comfortable, and visible. You want to be bright and to be bold and be seen. Velo Rosa's collections are designed to mix and match with coordinating kit pieces that allow women to get more mileage out of their cycling wardrobes. New for 2022, a completely redesigned cycling tank, reflective safety tabs on all of their tops, and more long sleeve options for those chilly morning rides. You'll find tons of great reviews on their site from women who love Velo Rosa gear. Their 5-star rated shorts prove that when women try them, they love the fit. Particularly the yoga waistband, power leg bands, and the super soft, all black, what stains, chamois. Whether you like to ride pavement, gravel, dirt, or your local trail system, cycling is about the community. Join the sisterhood of cyclists that is Velo Rosa today. Enter Feisty15, that's all caps, F-E-I-S-T-Y, number 15, at checkout, and receive 15% off of order of full-priced cycling wear at velorosacycling.com today. Active women need more protein. And if you're training hard, you need a lot more, like upwards of 100 grams a day or even more. That can be a challenge to get through meals alone some days, so a good protein powder like Neurify Plus from Prevenex can help. Neurify Plus is a vegan-friendly protein powder that is low in sugar, high in essential branched chain amino acids, and contains probiotics and digestive enzymes, so it's easy to digest and doesn't cause the gassy feeling you can get with other protein powders. Neurify Plus is laboratory tested and contains no soy, gluten, dairy, preservatives, or artificial sweeteners. Listeners of this series can get 15% off their first time purchase by using the code TITLE9, that's all caps and the number 9, at checkout. Just go to Prevenex.com, Prevenex.com, and use the code TITLE9 at checkout for 15% off your first purchase. If you don't like it, the company offers a 100% money-back guarantee on all of their products within 30 days, no questions asked. Again, use the code TITLE9 at checkout for 15% off your first-time purchase at Prevenex.com. Wow, what a great kickoff to this series. I want to thank Haley especially for such an awesome interview. And Sarah, who do we have up next week?
Yeah, I was, I actually like welled up a little bit listening to that interview, getting ready for this. So yeah, next week, speaking of welling up, I also cried during the interview next week. So our next week's interview, I did with Bobby Gibb, who was the first woman to run the Boston Marathon, unofficially. Catherine Switzer, I guess officially, though she, I don't really know how they define that, because
I don't either.
But in 1966, I do know now that Bobby Gibb traveled for 3 days across the country, hid in a bush and jumped out and ran the Boston Marathon, even though she was told she wasn't physically capable of it, even though she knew she was, because she ran 26 miles on a regular basis.
She ran it fast.
And she ran fast. So super stoked for next week. But yes, thanks again for the awesome interview, Haley and Wendy.
Nine Voices for Title IX, powered by Inside Tracker, is a Feisty Media production.
This episode was produced and edited by the amazing Amelia Perry.